Welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. We are in the thick of the holiday episodes, and you might have noticed by this point, if you hadn't been warned in last week of episodes of the show, that we're not doing normal news coverage. That will resume soon. In just a few days, we'll go back to breaking down the news that breaks every single morning. But we are doing special content for you. If you haven't already seen it, we've got the Year in Damage. That is our look back on the biggest, most important, and I would say most impactful stories of the year. Along the way, we have a ton of great guests that have been recurring characters on the show throughout the year. We also had our awards show, where we gave superlatives and awards to different aspects of American politics, some things that were not political as well. That one was a lot of fun. It was co-hosted by Brett Ehrlich. So look for all of those, either on our website or if you're a member, it's available there as well. In this episode, we're going to do things just a little bit differently, because there's been a lot of good things for me personally about being the host of The Damage Report, having this platform and this show throughout the year. But one of the best things has been the platform needed to draw awesome guests that I've been able to either interview or have them come on to comment on things that were going on in the news. And throughout this year, we have had so many amazing ones. And so in this episode, I want to look back at our first year of interviews and play some clips from some of the most important interviews we did with the largest newsmakers and things like that. And what's interesting is that while there were so many that we could choose from covering a wide range of different topics, in the end, as I was weeding down this list, we sort of landed on ones having to do with the election. It just turned out that some of the ones that I remembered the most had to do with the election all the way back to the primary and then to the reaction to the midterms. And so with a little bit of an exception, the five interviews that we're going to be giving you little snippets of in this episode are sort of the tale of the 2018 midterms. And we're going to start off with, I think, the standout interview, if only in hindsight, I guess, was that we were able to talk to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the eve of her primary win over Joe Crowley. That was an amazing opportunity that we had. She had just gotten back from the border. She's going to talk about that a little bit in the video. But it was a great honor at the time that she made time for us in literally the last hours of campaigning before her primary. And to then see her go on to great success has been amazing as well. So here she is. This is earlier this year on the eve of her primary win. So tomorrow brings primary elections in six states across the country, and we will be doing live coverage of it here on The Young Turks. But one of the most high-profile races is going to happen in New York's 14th district, where the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House, that's seven-term Congressman Joe Crowley, is facing a surprisingly serious challenge from educator and organizer Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who now joins us on the program. Welcome to the show, Alexandria.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us, especially since this is the last day of full campaigning before the election. So we certainly appreciate you sparing some of your time.
Yeah, that's right. Tomorrow is election day in New York, and everybody needs to know because a lot of folks don't know there's a June primary, and it's one of the most critical races that we have in 2018.
And I think we all know that lack of knowledge about primaries, of course, benefits incumbents. It's always the challenger that needs more education out there. So this is the 14th district. Can you tell us a little bit about what this district looks like?
So New York 14 is half in the Bronx. It's the eastern part of the Bronx, and it's half in Queens. So it's a very, very diverse district in many different ways. It is extremely working class. Median income is around $55,000 per year in New York City, which is a very working class average income. The district is about half immigrants, so that includes naturalized immigrants and all sorts of documentation statuses. It's about 70% people of color. We have not had a primary election in 14 years.
Wow.
The current incumbent was appointed to his seat. He was not elected through a contested primary. We have a really strong grassroots coalition that has come together in the fight for social, economic, and racial justice. So it's an exciting time.
So that's interesting, because as I alluded to in the intro, you always hear him talked about as the fourth most powerful Democrat in the House. Powerful, could be the speaker someday, but he's never actually had to go before the people and actually be elected. So you've told us a little bit about the district. So what about the match between this particular district and Joe Crowley? How has that worked out so far?
Well, it's been a really interesting race because not only is he the congressman, but he's also the chairman of the local Queens Democratic Party. So a lot of his history of governance here has really been very, very top down. And so there has been very little grassroots organizing happening here in the community. So a lot of people do not know who he is. A lot of people do not know his history or how he even got to power. They don't even know that he chooses to live full time in Virginia. Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty strong disconnect. And I think the reason that our campaign has been effective is because we decided from day one to go out and organize and talk to directly to the people. And that has been our goal and our aim and our priority since day one. And that's what it continues to be tomorrow. My opponent is almost entirely financed by corporations, PACs, and big money. About 99% of all of his fundraising comes from corporate PACs, big money lobbyists. We're talking about luxury real estate developers, Wall Street banks, pharmaceutical corporations, private equity groups, many of which actually profit from the detention of immigrants, actually. But that's a whole other issue. My campaign is 100. I've taken a public pledge not to accept any corporate money. So 0% of the money that goes into financing my campaign comes from corporate lobbyists. And my campaign additionally is overwhelmingly financed by small dollar contributions. And the definition for a small dollar contribution by the Federal Elections Commission is less than $200. So there's kind of like a dual, there's kind of like two layers here. Like the first step is to not take any corporate PAC money. But the second, I think, kind of gold star is the amount of money that you raise from small dollar contributions. And so I'm proud to say, you know, these final fundraising days have been changing so much, but about 70% of our contributions come from a large, massive amount of small dollar donors, less than $200.
And I believe that I read that that same number for him is at 1%, if I'm not mistaken.
Less than 1%, so 0.75% or 0.79% is how much of his total fundraising has come from small dollar contributions.
Okay, so let's talk about the stakes of your campaign. You said that the people in your district there's not been a lot of organizing. Many might not even be aware that he is the congressman. So as you've been going door to door, what issues are you finding most salient with the people of the 14th?
Well, I think that it's the same issues that working class Americans all over the country are concerned with: housing, education, and healthcare. Additionally, because our district is so unique, immigration and clearing just equitable paths for immigration is actually a very top priority for voters in this district. Almost everybody in this district, if you are not an immigrant yourself, or if you do not come from an immigrant family yourself, you either know, love, or you know, or are part of an immigrant community. And so that security, that way of life, that pride, that New York 14 is a place where people start their American stories is very important to the people here.
You've spent the last couple of days down at the border, correct?
Yes, I have.
And so what did you see down there? Were you able to gain access to any of these facilities? Were there other politicians there? What was your experience?
So I headed to the first child detention site in Tornillo, Texas. I went at the request of several activists and organizations like Voto Latino and Raices Texas to go down and view what was going on for myself. Many of these camps do not allow for tours. And when I went up there to the fence, though, I went right up to the entrance. I was speaking with the border officers. I looked off into the distance and I saw these white tents. I saw the white tents that were kind of seeing pop up in photos in TV or in articles. And I asked one of these officers, "Is that where you all are keeping the children?" And he looked back at me and he said, "I'm not authorized to disclose any of that information." But what we're seeing, at least what we saw on the ground in Tornillo with other journalists, is that the facts here are not getting out, no matter what they are. we are seeing inaccurate or cross-wired accounts from BPD, from ICE, from DHS. And even when certain officials are even able to get to the camp, they're not even allowed access to view the children. They're being shown CCTV footage in some instances. So I think what we have here is a moral crisis. And there are going to be several actions on June 30th and June 2nd, I believe, on June 30th and July 2nd, rather, on responding to this. Mm-hmm. As Maria Teresa Kumar of Voto Latino said, they may start with the most vulnerable people, but they will not end there. And we need to make sure that a very clear moral message that the separation of children and the detention of their families and the deportation of their parents is morally unacceptable. It is a clear violation of human rights, and that if need be, we must resist through the occupation of borders, checkpoints, etc. If our Congress will not act, we need to act.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alexandria, and good luck in your primary tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so I couldn't love that more. A couple of reasons that I love that throwback, though, is understand that, I guess in my lifetime, I don't know if I can name another politician that has risen from virtually no one except for complete, you know, people who pay attention to this every single day, knowing who she is, to commonly talked about, you know, on, you know, the big, you know, late night shows and talked about constantly with the speed that she has. So she absolutely blew up. I think the day that we did that interview, she had 17,000 Twitter followers, I think. And now she's got like 1.5 million, like huge, huge burst and obviously influence and popularity and all that. And yet she's still the same person that she was before that primary, let alone before the general election. Like the way that she talks about campaign finance, the way that she talks about the people of her district, the way that she talks about advocating for working class issues is the same, even though every single day from when we did that interview to now, like she's being hounded for interviews. She's being talked to about these policies. Everybody's trying to get her to sign on to everything. She still sounds like the same person, and that is absolutely awesome. Now, I would have loved to have played a more recent interview between me and her, but unfortunately, she's been so busy, she hasn't come back on. So this is a good place for you. If you would like to see her come back on, feel free to suggest it on social media. Maybe we can get her. Obviously, she's very in demand, but we would love to talk to her about the issues, in particular, the Green New Deal. So a lot more that I could say about that. I mean, obviously, one of the highlights of the entire year for me was being able to interview her. But we do have a lot more interviews to get to. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Nina Turner appears on the show.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Okay, so continuing with our chain of interviews, let's move a little bit further into the primary. So at this point, Alexandria had already won, but there had been some candidates that had lost. I mean, let's keep it real. Like, there were huge wins this year, but there were also really devastating losses, both in the general election, but much earlier in the primaries as well. And so with that context, we had on Nina Turner. Now, Nina Turner, very familiar to you. She's not only was an advocate for Bernie Sanders, president of Our Revolution, but also hosts We the People on the TYT network, the podcast network. She came on the show, and from a much more inside position in terms of the operation of Our Revolution, their advocacy for different candidates, both wins and losses, here is what she had to say about the way the primaries were going.
Nina is not only the president of Our Revolution, professor, she's also the host of We the People, one of the newest podcasts on the TYT audio network. Welcome to the show, Nina.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. So there's a lot of topics that I want to talk with you about. But on the show, we were just speaking about Nike's new partnership with Colin Kaepernick and some of the protests against that. How do you react to the way that many Americans have greeted Nike working with Colin Kaepernick?
It's very disappointing. It's very ridiculous. I know that they're burning Nike gear. I saw one, John, you probably saw this one, where this guy cut out, you know, cut holes in his Nike gear and put it on like he was wearing a KKK hood.
Oh, I missed that.
You know, it's just disgusting. And it's just yet one more reminder that this country does specialize in racism and bigotry, that we have some demons in this country that we need to really deal with. We do need a truth and reconciliation, you know, similar to what they did in South Africa. And it certainly is not that all is well in South Africa, but at least at first, you know, when President Nelson Mandela was taken over, they did have the courage to say we do need to have truth and reconciliation. We have never had that in this country. We pretend as if we have overcome racism and bigotry and discrimination, and we have not. So I am the PG version of what I'm able to say on your show, since it's a daytime show, is that I am very disappointed that some Americans would choose to do that over Colin Kaepernick, who is really a modern day freedom fighter, in my opinion.
Now, so look, obviously, as you point out, we've had these racial problems, including, you know, institutionalized racism, laws, Jim Crow, police brutality, all this lynching, you know, all of that.
Yes.
And now we have, it's very out in front, like we have literal Nazis marching. Donald Trump appears to have emboldened some of these people, but he's really playing on a history that we've had since before the United States was even a country. If we were to be able to snap our fingers and get rid of Donald Trump, how much, if at all, do you think that would actually help America in dealing with some of these racial issues?
It wouldn't help much, John. I mean, I think for us, and you hit the nail on the head, Jim Crow, you know, slavery itself, black codes, and we're talking about institutional racism. And sometimes people don't get that. We're not just talking about one individual that is a bigot. We're talking about within the systems in this country, socially, politically, economically. We're talking about systemic racism. But if President Trump went away, it may make some folks feel comfortable that the symbol itself, i.e. the colored water fountain, if you will, and the white water fountain is not staring us in our face. But what is happening under the presidency of Donald Trump is that we're forced to come face to face with the fact that those demons, the demons of race and bigotry, still plague this country, even though generation after generation, we certainly have made progress. But it was very easy when you have presidents and other leaders who don't embrace that for us to think as a country that we have really overcome. We have overcome a little, but we have many more miles to go. So it wouldn't really change what is deep seated in the nature of this country, John. And that is the part that I think many leaders are afraid to really deal with. Mr. Trump is a convenient excuse, but when he is gone, what will be our excuse to deal with racism and bigotry when we don't have somebody like him in the White House?
Nina, hi, Brooke Thomas here. I want to ask you a question a little bit about yourself. I've seen you described more than once as unapologetically black, and I think your presence is uplifting for a lot of people, and I've seen that online. I want to know, when it comes to politics, we are in this weird space in our country right now, maybe not necessarily new, but weird. How important is it for you to be just authentically yourself?
Brooke, very important. And thank you for that question. I rarely get questions about myself, but it is vitally important for me to be who I am. I mean, just, you know, when we talk about in the black community, black from a distance, you know, that's me. And also the way that I comport myself, the way that I talk, the way that I express, I bring the thunder and the rain and the lightning, you know, just being me. It is important to be able to do that. And I'm really excited that in this country, even though we still have many more miles to go, there is been more of an embrace, because Brooke, as you know, because we shared, you know, the same skin, maybe not necessarily totally the same experiences, but we do know that Black women in particular, you know, whether it's our hair that's political, we're angry when we're being assertive, when we do have every right to be mad as hell about a whole bunch of stuff that's going on in this country. But it's refreshing to be able to do that. And you know, I'm young enough now that I can't be anything else but who I am. And so what I express and what I bring to the world is the fierceness that God has certainly blessed me with.
And that is actually what I want to turn to now. The mission of our revolution is obviously to have the right sorts of candidates actually win office. And in this primary cycle, we have had a number of really great candidates. Some big wins, a few unfortunate and painful losses. But I want to turn to one in particular. So no one has been talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I'll be the one person to actually talk about it. No, but she won. And ever since then, there has been a level of critical analysis of every word that she speaks, every move that she makes, trying to find perceived missteps and things like that. How have you reacted to the hypercritical focus on people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and especially other progressive women?
I've talked to Alexandria and just told her to keep her eye on the prize. You're always gonna have haters. Haters gonna hate. That's what they do. But she has to stay focused, and she is doing a tremendous job. You know, not only did she win, beat the number four person in the United States Congress on the Democratic side, shook things up in a way that we really needed on the progressive side, but she's also out there helping her other sisters and brothers who have primaries that are, you know, difficult and challenging primaries. As a matter of fact, I'll be going to Delaware tomorrow to help Ms. Harris, who's running for the US Senate, and Ocasio-Cortez has been there. So she just has to keep her eye on the prize and stay focused and not allow people to pull her off her game. You know, we all make mistakes, we all have missteps, we all say, you know, things that we wish we could take back or have phrased, you know, or phrase it a different way. She is on a mission to lift this country. Her very presence is doing that. And she's not just sitting on her laurels. So I say, as I advise her, forget the haters, just keep focused and serve the people of your district. And by extension, she's serving the citizens of this country. So very proud of her.
Yeah. So far we have we've been doing live primary coverage, and we'll be doing it later tonight. And we have a running joke that every time another Our Revolution backed candidate wins, Politico writes another article about how Our Revolution is falling apart. And yes, the crowd is huge and growing. How satisfied are you so far with this primary cycle and the ability of progressive primary challengers to win?
I'm very satisfied, John, and you're right. Speaking of haters, are going to hate a political, certainly in that category. They won't give us, you know, even if it's one of our candidates, they'll find a way to say that the revolution is dead. But the revolution, the state of the revolution is strong. And as you mentioned, listen, we are going to lose some. So newsflash, when you are challenging establishment candidates, when you are going against the grain, when you are shaking things up, when you are taking risk, when you are the man or the woman in the arena, to give a shout out to President Teddy Roosevelt, oh yeah, you're gonna lose some. We just celebrated our second birthday. Happy birthday, Our Revolution. And we are winning almost 50% of our races. And we do take the hard races. You know, as I shared with my team the other day, some people have a smooth surface. Some people have to overcome rocks. Some people got to jump mountains or hills, and other people have to jump mountains. Well, guess the assignment that Our Revolution has taken on? We're jumping mountains, baby. We're mountain jumpers.
Look, I know obviously our viewers are going to be really excited for you to be on the show, but I'm going to keep it real. I just have you on to get me fired up. I just need this every once in a while.
Are you fired now, Ray?
I want to cover some primaries right now. I don't know about you. Nina Turner, thank you so much for joining the Damage Report. Please don't be a stranger. We'd love to have you back on.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you, Brooke.
Thank you.
So as you can tell, this is me again, if you listen to the podcast. So that was obviously a lot of fun to have her on. We love talking to Nina Turner. I've had the opportunity to interview her a couple of times. And it's great that she's also a part of our network now with the podcast We the People, which you should, of course, look up and take stock of. At that time, you know, it's the election turnout, pretty good, actually. We had the wave and all that. But at that time, I was starting to get just a little bit worried with some of the losses. So it was great to have her on and to fire us up. Coming as she does from Our Revolution, she knows like the struggle and the achievements that they've been able to get in just the 2 years that they'd existed at that point. So it's great to have her on. Hopefully, we will in the future as well. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, there was a big story that helped, I think, redirect public opinion away from the Republicans in the run-up to the election that had sort of up until that point, things had been looking like they were working in their favor just a little bit. Huge story. We had an activist from inside of that story come on the show. We'll have that for you after this. One of the biggest stories in the run-up to the election was the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, and the I think it's safe to say divisive conversation leading up to it. Obviously, considering the things that he did, there was a huge amount of activism to try to stop him from getting on the Supreme Court. And we were lucky enough to have Piper Perabo, actress and activist, on the show, not just for an interview, but to co-host an entire episode of the show. And as part of that, she spoke about her efforts to stop Brett Kavanaugh.
We are now in day three of the Kavanaugh hearings, and just in the time when we're doing our production for the show, things have really heated up with calls to bring it, which we'll be breaking down. But it's also been hot from the first day when I believe 72 protesters were arrested at those Kavanaugh hearings. And I am thrilled that we are joined in studio by one of perhaps the most high profile of those arrestees, actress and activist Piper Perabo is joining us in studio.
Nice to be here.
It is great to have you here.
Thanks.
I've been following you and your social media activism for quite a long time, and you've put your body on the line in this case because of your concerns about Kavanaugh and what he would represent on the Supreme Court. So we've got a lot that we're going to talk about today, not just with Kavanaugh, but many topics. But on Kavanaugh, I do want to start with your experience. What was your goal in protesting his nomination hearing?
I felt like because Trump is an unindicted co-conspirator in a felony charge, that he shouldn't be allowed to appoint judges right now. Mm-hmm. And they're rushing this through, and we don't have the votes to stop it. And so I had to do something, and you can't just sit on Twitter and say you disagree. Eventually, you have to do something. And an activist that I know, Audie Barkin, had said to me one time, getting arrested is a privilege because it requires citizenship and bail and time, and you have to be okay missing work. And so ever since he said that to me, I thought, oh, I'm going to wait until something is really important, and then I'm going to get arrested for it.
Yeah, and it certainly is. I mean, people who are working, one to three jobs can't necessarily afford it. I mean, they don't have time to vote, let alone time to spend a few nights in jail. So I appreciate you doing that. And you were one of many who were arrested. What was the reaction like to what happened?
Do you mean in the room?
In the room at the time, but also, how have people greeted that action since then?
In the room, I was kind of scared. I was never been arrested before, and that room was packed that morning. I mean, like to the rafters in all the galleys. There was so much press. Every seat was taken. And in general, I don't really believe in interrupting, so I was really nervous to interrupt senators. But once it started, then it was just sort of we were doing what we had planned to do, where each person would stand up and say why they objected to this nominee. And so once we started, it was easier. And then after it happened, the police take away all your possessions when you get arrested. Mm-hmm. So there were hours that went that I didn't know what was going on in the hearings. But when I got out, people were, it was kind of a mixed reaction. I mean, my friends and family were really supportive. And then, of course, on Twitter, you get a lot of trolls and haters.
Yeah, and there's a particular component of that reaction that I want to focus on. But I believe we also have some video of the actual arrest happening. So why don't we roll that? Rough there.
Yeah, you could
see on your arm.
Yeah, well, they're police officers.
Yeah.
Civil disobedience.
I guess we've seen worse.
Yeah.
I saw that you had tweeted out earlier today an excerpt from an email that he had sent. Now, he has been saying from the beginning of these hearings, I'm going to be just a fair, neutral judge. Roe v. Wade is the stated law of the land. And, I'm just going to take things as I see them. I want to focus on the section that you had circled at the bottom, saying, I am not sure that all legal scholars refer to Roe as the settled law of the land at the Supreme Court level, since court can always overrule its precedent, and three current justices on the court would do so. The point there is in the inferior court point. So he goes on to other points. But what he's saying there is he doesn't actually think that it's a settled law of the land, or that this it being the settled law of the land actually matters. And so I am curious if you pointed out that we don't currently have the votes necessarily to change that, although we've got the phone number at the bottom to hopefully put pressure on some senators who might. How much faith do you have that if he gets on the court by the end, by 2020, by 2024, Roe v. Wade will even exist?
Whoa.
Sorry to hit you with early on in the show.
I mean, I'm just still if he gets on the court, You know, he says in the hearings that there's precedent on precedent because of Roe and then Planned Parenthood, and that he just is going to follow precedent. But you can tell, and you can tell that that's not true, and how he personally feels. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of relying on this thing that I think Ginsburg started, where they don't answer except based on precedent. And so he can sort of hide behind that.
Yeah.
And so we need these documents so that we can see how he really feels. And also Trump said that he wants to pick a judge that would overturn it. Yeah. So I feel sure that he will.
Trump had said during the campaign that he wants there should be punishment for getting an abortion.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what we can do if he gets on the court is really focus on our state legislatures, because that's who's gonna decide the law in your state. Mm-hmm. And it's gonna all go to the states. And so then that's why it's so important in these primaries and in the midterms that you don't just vote at the top of the ticket, but you really look at your state legislature, because that's who really decides what's going on for you, especially in an administration like this.
And of course, unfortunately, he did get on the Supreme Court. But regardless, it was great to have the opportunity to talk with Piper, and hopefully she'll come back on the show again at some point. That said, more interviews for you on the other side. From one activist to another, Alyssa Milano actually joined us the day before the midterm elections. We talked about a lot of things, but I want to focus on what she said was actually at stake in these elections.
This election matters to me because so much is at stake. Women's lives are at risk without Roe. Dreamers' lives are at risk without DACA. Black lives are at risk without policy that ensures that they matter. Immigrant children's lives are at risk without being with their families.
Yeah.
So we're really in a time where it's really scary. There's a lot at stake. You know, American lives are at risk without the Affordable Care Act. The list goes on and on. I can't remember a time when so much is at stake. And I think the most important thing I could say on the eve of the election, and people have heard me say this numerous times, but in case someone hasn't heard me say it, I want to say it again. Voting is how we protect each other. Voting, if you could take yourself out of it and say, I'm going to vote to protect my neighbor, to protect my brother, to protect my sister, mm-hmm. to protect all of those that need protection that don't even know that they need protection. Take yourself out of it. Go vote for someone you love. Go vote for something you care about.
Yeah.
And protect one another. And that's what this election comes down to for me. Yeah. You know, I've been politically active since 2000. And mm-hmm. in 2000, we sort of faced not similar, but also an outrageous outcome, which was when Gore lost the election. And that sort of ignited in me a sense of political responsibility that I felt that I had mm-hmm. to sort of uphold having a platform that I had. It never occurred to me that being a celebrity meant that I couldn't have a political ideology. It actually meant to me that I had to have more of a political ideology mm-hmm. because I take my platform very, very seriously in it. And so I've been, you know, for 20 years driving people to the polls and doing
really?
This. It's a busy day, but to me, driving people to the polls is so hopeful. It not only keeps me not glued to the TV and not vomiting in the toilet, but it also, I get to connect with people and ask them, you know, what does it mean to you to not only be able to vote, but what are the issues in your district that are getting you out to the polls today? And that's just such a special thing to be able to do. And I cherish that so much. So I'm very excited. Since 2016, what were my options? My options were either to stay in the fetal position for 2 years under the covers with the lights off, or to actually get out there and feel like I'm actively making a difference.
Yeah.
So I chose to sort of get out there. And it's not anything unlike I've normally done. It just feels a lot more intensive because the stakes are so much higher.
Yeah.
To me, I have to be able to sleep with myself at night and look at myself in the mirror and know that all the hard work in my acting career actually leads to something fulfilling, which to me is to be able to help people and to live a life of service.
Yeah.
There are a few people, I think, political activists that were busier than Alyssa Milano was over the course of the election, all over the country, advocating on a number of different issues. Obviously, she was incredibly busy during the Kavanaugh hearings and advocating against him. And so it was great to have her take time out to come on the show right before the midterm elections, which thankfully turned out pretty good. We're going to take one more break. We come back. We have an interview with Lauren Duca actually right after the elections. What were our initial impressions after this? So there have been a lot of guests that have been just fun to talk to, you know, about politics. Like obviously, we're in this job because we think it's important, but also because we genuinely like talking about these things. And one of the guests who came on a couple of times this year, that's got to be right up there with Emma Vigeland, and you could just talk to her about politics and it's just fun, would be Lauren Duca. And it's a little bonus that she gets under the skin of right-wingers more than almost any other woman in the country. So that has been a lot of fun to watch as well over the course of the year. Lauren joined us twice, once about halfway through the year, but then also within just a few days of the midterm elections, gave us her impression of how things went, and here it is.
First, on the midterms, there's this debate going on about whether it was actually a wave, whether it was actually a win. I'm seeing like Brett Stevens is saying this is proof that the Democrats need to reach out to the right. What do you think about this debate? Was it actually a win?
I mean, I think that we've just lost so much to the kind of narrative industry in the political conversation now. This was never going to look like a landslide. That's not the way change happens. I'm most interested in the way government is completely changing its face. I mean, the women that were elected, the first time runners that were elected, and the youth turnout. This is the highest participation in a quarter century, and it's just the midterms. So I don't know. I am optimistic and geared up, and I'm not gonna lie, I ordered another drink when I saw Gillum and Beto lost, but I think that overall that we see progress.
Yeah, I do wanna ask you about some of those races. So you mentioned there we had historic total numbers of female candidates winning. We're gonna have the mm-hmm. highest representation, I believe, in Congress. And then you had standout
100
races.
Women will be seated for the first time in history. I mean, that's
exactly.
Yeah.
Which is still wildly underrepresented, of course. We should acknowledge that. But history, yay. So you also had people of color winning in many races. You had LGBTQ candidates. Do you think that this is something that is definitely going to be built on in future elections? Is there any way to get, because almost all these wins were on the Democratic side, are we going to see any more representation on the Republican side in terms of more female candidates, people of color, things like that?
I mean, it's hard to talk about this because I am somebody who, you know, has a set of journalistic ethics and also tends to identify with what is perceived as the left. So I guess something I want to be really clear about before I get into that question is I think that there is only one side right now. And I think that the one side is preserving democracy. And then once we can get that back in check, rebuilding it and fighting for equity and a true, you know, a truer, more equitable version of democracy. There's all different labels for all of those things. We tend to see this new electorate, this new leadership is happening most visibly on the left because those policies tend to track with equity. And what we're seeing on the right right now is a lot of nationalism mm-hmm. at varying degrees. So I don't know if there are going to be more women running in the right, but I think that that's sort of an irrelevant question because there's such a crisis of ethics happening that are upholding white supremacist patriarchy through policy and the people who remain in power. And something that I'm not gonna lie was an extremely upsetting takeaway is that you have such high turnout in a place like Texas
yeah.
and Ted Cruz winning. I always want there to be more people voting. But I am honestly truly mystified by the women showing up in droves to vote for Ted Cruz. And so I think that we still on the right, there are politically active women, there are politically active young people. I don't like to think about that. And I don't totally understand what they're fighting for, but I think it has to do with who this country belongs to and doesn't, and preserving old power structures. And I'm not very interested in that.
Yeah, so related to that, I noticed, I think it was in the governor's race in Georgia, I think white women voted 74% for Brian Kemp, which is a gigantic turnout there. So that's certainly rough. There's definitely a lot of progress needed to be made in a bunch of different areas. You briefly mentioned Ted Cruz. Was that one of the worst nights of the election for you when that race was called?
I mean, you know, I think that those were the two of the big ticket items. Obviously, the third was Stacey Abrams, and you had hope for one of those three coming through. I still do think that the fact that these people were able to call into question what might have been an impossibility, and by the way, Stacey Abrams is still not totally out of the conversation here. Yep. I think that was crushing to see the two of them. I wasn't sure how tuned in to be. But I think that, you know, what Beto has done and awakened is something we can talk about kind of across the country, where people are having these conversations more and more. They're opening their eyes to what is possible, and seeds are being planted. And, you know, people who are from Texas are now saying, holy crap, that I might have the right to have a representative who actually represents me, who I'm actually excited in. And this is not just an inevitability, and I don't just have to accept, you know, a sack of cockroaches as the state of my representation. And I think that we see that those conversations spreading. People are looking at what's possible. People are looking at new possibilities for what can happen. And so even though this was a loss in a lot of ways, it's more of a rumbling of an awakening that will continue to happen and hopefully feels much bigger in 2 years from now.
I have one more question for you. So like the day after the election, we had Donald Trump's press conference, and he was, you know, he's his normal awful self, but he's been brawling with reporters. He seemed to have set his sights on every black female reporter that he can come across. He's changing the asylum laws. He banned a reporter. He fired Jeff Sessions. So he's been making a lot of moves these last few days. Like, he's been awful for 2 years. But he's been awful with unified government. Now he's going to face actual opposition. Are you worried that, as bad as things have been, that we could have an actual worse, darker Donald Trump for the next 2 years?
I mean, it's always going to be worse. Like, every day, I think it's just worse based on projections of the past, you know, 2 years. Yes, but I guess that is a check that we didn't have before. So I mean, I think that it will be crucial in, as we continue to see the rise of authoritarianism and, you know, I mean, just even this complete and total disregard for anything even resembling democracy at this point. It's like, there's not a hyperbolic way to put it. Yeah. So at least there is some formal power to check, to keep some sort of a check on it. And I mean, it is frightening how much power Mitch McConnell has now too, but there's some, one half of the branches of government might keep us on track to not becoming China.
So, Brooke, you had a question?
I do. Lauren, hi, good morning. I want to know, back to what we were talking about, the midterms and you know, a lot of like this awakening of voters. But I want to know, does this make you hopeful? Even in the races that lost or we're not sure about, they are so tight. Does this make you hopeful for, and everything that went well, encouraging more future politicians that they can run on these incredibly, you know, humane and progressive platforms, and that it can work?
Yes, and I hope so. And I also think it can't really be even understated that the fact that these races are even happening, when they're even unsuccessful, I mean, the work of campaigning, the work of running, that invigorates the health of democracy. Obviously, as I am very transparent about, I support it with progressive candidates, but really anybody running, you're talking to more people, you're knocking on more doors, you're getting more voters to even begin to be aware that the positions exist. Like, when we're talking about the top of the ticket, but it goes all the way down and to elected office at the local level, where you have people start to think about their agency differently. And the more people we can have running, the healthier our democracy is going to be. And I mean, I think Run for Something, that specific organization, has had such a boon in the past 2 years. I mean, they've completely taken off, and they have some interesting statistics that I don't have top of mind. But I mean, I think people are only just getting started, and now we're seeing even more concrete evidence, and hopefully it will build and build. But that, I mean, I think that is absolutely an optimistic takeaway.
Okay, and I think that is a good optimistic point to end on as well. Lauren Duca, thank you for joining us once again on the Damage Report. Great to have you here.
Obviously, it's always great having her on. I know that she's got some big plans that she's not quite ready to announce, but hopefully once she's got that squared away, she'll be able to return to the show. There were so many other great interviews this year that I would have loved to have shown part of. I mean, we had Ro Khanna multiple times. Pramila Jayapal, James Cromwell, having Lori Pena was awesome, Ben Jealous, so many. And I've asked you recently who you'd like to see on the show, and a lot of the people that you were suggesting, we actually are working to get on the show in the near future. So next year, we want to expand the list of activists and politicians, authors, and all of that that we have on, more reporters and everything, and hopefully more great interviews for you in 2019. Thank you so much for watching. We will see you tomorrow with more.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.